I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Welcome to Radio Times. Things are back to normal along the U.S.-Mexico border at Tijuana, if normal means long waits for asylum seekers who are camping out in a baseball field. The mayor of Tijuana has called the situation a humanitarian crisis. On Sunday, U.S. border agents fired tear gas on migrants protesting near the border after some attempted to get through the barriers. Photos show women and children fleeing the noxious fumes. Kirsten Nielsen, head of Homeland Security, defended the use of tear gas and claimed that some of the women and children were being used as human shields by migrants, throwing rocks and projectiles at law enforcement. President Trump threatened to close the border for a, quote, long time. His administration has put up legal and physical roadblocks to prevent migrants coming from Central America from entering the country. Joining us from Tijuana is Sarah Kenosian. She's a freelance journalist, and she covers Mexico and Central America. Sarah Kenosian, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
And with us here in our Philadelphia studios is Jaya Ramji Nogales. She's the I. Herman Stern Research Professor and Associate Dean for Academic Affairs at Temple University's Beasley School of Law, where she teaches refugee law and policy. And Jaya Ramji Nogales, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks so much for having me.
Sarah, you are in Tijuana. Describe what is happening in that city today. I don't think our connection has worked. We're going to try to get her back on Skype. In the meanwhile, I will talk with you, Jaya Ramji Nogales. Sometimes those long-distance calls don't always work out on Radio Times. What from the reporting that you have read and what you have observed, what do you see happening in Tijuana today?
So what I see happening is, they say in the range of 8,000 to 10,000 migrants. It's obviously hard to get an accurate head count. At the border, trying to gain protection, and these are migrants fleeing some of the most dangerous countries in the world. El Salvador and Honduras, for example, have some of the highest homicide rates in the world, in the top 10, even perhaps higher. So these countries are what they're fleeing is really like a war zone, like what you would see in Syria and Afghanistan. What we're also seeing that's really striking at the border is a real shift in who is coming to the border. So first of all, the Trump administration talks about a deluge at the border. That's actually just not factually accurate.
Deluge meaning what? Thousands of people?
Thousands of people. Actually, in fiscal year 2017, we hit a 46-year low in border apprehensions at the southwest border. So we're seeing fewer people coming over, and we're seeing 40% of these apprehensions are children and family members. This has never happened before. We've never seen, in the past, it's been single men seeking work, and now we're seeing families bringing their children to the border to seek protection.
And you said about 40%?
Yes, about 40% at the moment.
Yeah. Sarah, I think we have you back on Skype. Fingers crossed here, Sarah Kenosian, joining us from Tijuana. I began by asking you to describe what is happening in Tijuana today based on what we saw on Sunday when there was the tear gassing of migrants who were protesting along the border and clearly some of them trying to get through the barriers there. What's happening today?
Yeah, so today, and just like yesterday, the calm has been restored. Migrants are still camped out at this rundown sports complex. They're basically sleeping shoulder to shoulder on, you know, slabs of cardboard, on blankets, in tents. Right now I'm down right by where asylum seekers put their name on an unofficial list to wait to apply for asylum. So I think now, after Sunday, people are kind of weighing their options about what to do. Many people say, we will still continue to wait in hopes of applying for asylum, while others are saying, hey, I guess I'll stay in Tijuana a little bit, maybe try and get a job. And then you have young men that are planning to cross, illegally.
Crossing illegally, meaning forcing their way through or looking for holes in the barriers?
Looking for holes in the barriers or looking for smugglers. Many people are aware that getting asylum in the United States is really difficult. And even many people who tell me their stories of fleeing gang violence and such say, but I don't have any proof. so the United States is not going to give me asylum, because it is quite hard to prove that somebody came to your house and told you that they were going to murder you. And so I think that people are kind of aware of the situation. But most families, for instance, are definitely planning for the long haul wait, which is about 2 months.
Which is about 2 months. And interestingly, and I think importantly, the mayor of Tijuana calling this a humanitarian crisis. As you described, these are people, out in the open on a baseball field.
Yeah. And I mean, Tijuana gets pretty cold. You know, it's the morning here and it's pretty chilly, and they're showering outside in freezing cold water. The sports complex where they are, officials had initially said that there is a capacity of 3,000. It's now approaching 6,000 people who are in there. So it's very cramped. Food is barely stretching to meet the demands of everyone. So it's getting to be pretty critical. Yesterday, they told me about 100 people signed up to go back to Honduras.
Wow. So 100 out of the 6,000 there. Is this the caravan, or is the caravan still on its way to the border?
No, this is the caravan. The caravan has been arriving for the past 2 weeks, really. The first caravan has arrived, and then, you know, there are several other caravans that left El Salvador and several more that left Honduras that came up behind it. And so now people are just trickling in, most right now from Mexicali, where they've arrived.
Is there evidence that women and children were used as human shields? I believe the president talked about migrants calling them the grabbers, grabbing children and running for the border. Is there evidence of that?
No, I was there from start to finish right by the border fence on Sunday, and that definitely didn't happen. There were, you know, families and women with their children that were approaching the border fence. None of them I saw trying to cross the border fence. You know, that was young men. That didn't happen.
How about projectiles and rocks thrown at border agents? There were reports that happened. Can you verify that, Sarah, one way or the other?
Yeah, there were, when they first got to the fence, there were some young men that were, you know, throwing some rocks. And that, you know, was met with tear gas. Down the road by the Tijuana Canal, I didn't see anyone throwing rocks before they started shooting tear gas. But it's a very chaotic situation. But I wouldn't say that at all represented the majority of what was happening. But there was a bit of rock throwing.
Jay, let me turn back to you. And much has been raised about the use of tear gas, which is banned in warfare. Apparently, in the Obama administration, I think back in 2013, there was the use of, I don't think tear gas, but rubber pellets. But nonetheless, U.S. forces have taken on migrants before.
Yes. And it seems to me just a striking misuse of resources to do that, right? And as we see now, right, these are women and children, and to bring in the expense and the might of National Guard, other forces, it's just really not necessary, and it's a signal that the asylum process, that should be a safe, lawful means to process people and determine whether they have the right to stay in the U.S., just isn't working.
Sarah, you mentioned that the wait for asylum processing, and that is really essentially an interview, and then the process begins, that wait could be 2 months?
Yeah, that's correct. And the way that they do it is through migrants. Asylum seekers themselves maintain an unofficial list right here at the pedestrian border crossing in Tijuana. They work in coordination with Mexican immigration authorities, who work in coordination with CBP. And then people come, they put their name down on the list, they get a number, and then they have to keep coming back to see if today's the day they'll be let in. Something that I think is interesting is that for the past few days, CBP has only been allowing around 40 people a day. They had said, you know, that it was going to be around 100 a day, but for the past three, it's been 40.
Been 40 a day. What kind of crisis has this created for the Mexican government?
Well, what's interesting is that there's going to be a change of power in Mexico. They get a new president on December 1.
Right.
You know,
that's
one of
Saturday,
the main...
I should add. That's Saturday.
Yeah, they, you know, city officials in Tijuana are really wringing their hands over the fact that the federal government has not provided them with the resources that they've requested. You know, I asked him yesterday, the head of migrant services here, are you guys going to open another shelter? And he said, I can't open another shelter if I don't have any money. Uh-huh. And so, you know, the current government has been pretty non-responsive, I think, sort of hoping to just sort of get to the end. There's been transition team members of the incoming government of López Obrador that are here. They say they're reviewing the situation, but have no promised funds at this moment.
And you mentioned that there are several options. One is to wait and hope that you can get asylum granted. I guess you could sneak across. You could also go back where you came from. And I'm curious, Sarah, is that truly an option for people in Tijuana today?
I mean, for some people, of course. You know, it's a group of 6,000, and not every single one of them lives will be in danger if they return. There is, you know, the people who, for instance, I spoke with a ton of people who went on the bus back yesterday, and, you know, those were sort of more quote unquote economic migrants. But, you know, one thing I would point out is that the economic situation in Honduras is pretty grave. Hmm. 2/3 of the population lives in poverty. Of those with work, 80% are paid under the minimum wage, which is, you know, a few hundred dollars a month. So, you know, these are real economic problems that they're dealing with here. And now then there's the people who are staying and who aren't choosing to go back. And those are the people who are truly fleeing for their lives.
Sarah, final question to you. President Trump talked about criminals and gang members who were part of this migrant population. Again, based on your reporting, is there evidence of that?
No, you know, the majority of people are fleeing gang violence, so it's the other way around. You know, I have seen no evidence that gang members have infiltrated the caravan. So I don't, in these countries, you know, they make all these. There's a lot of statistics that link everyone to gangs, and it's just. You know, it's like if you're a family member or something, that they just assign this label to you. But most people here are fleeing threats from multiple gangs. It's the MS-13, it's the Barrio 18th Street, it's multiple. And they all tell me they can't go back.
Well, Sarah, I appreciate you joining us today on Radio Times. Thanks so much, and I appreciate your reporting as well.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And that's Sarah Kenossian joining us by Skype from Tijuana in Mexico. And again, a freelance journalist who's been covering Mexico and Central America and the crisis along the U.S.-Mexico border. Jaya Ramji Nogales staying with us, and we will talk more about refugees and asylum. And we'll take calls and comments after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. In early November, President Trump banned migrants from making asylum applications if they weren't at a legal checkpoint, claiming it was a national security issue. Federal Judge John Tygar blocked the government from carrying out this order, saying the Trump administration must accept asylum claims from anywhere in the country. Quote, whatever the scope of the president's authority, he may not rewrite immigration laws to impose a condition that Congress has expressly forbidden. As I said, Jaya Ramji Nogales staying with us for the rest of the hour. She's a professor at Temple University's Beasley School of Law, teaches refugee law and policy. You can join our conversation. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Is it against the law to apply for asylum in the United States?
Well, so far, it's not. Judge Tygar is referring to two things there. First of all, he's talking, of course, about checks and balances. And he's talking about the fact that the authority to regulate immigration lies squarely with our legislative branch, with Congress. Congress can delegate to the president. Some cases where Congress hasn't spoken, the president can step in. But here, the law on the books that the judge is looking at is very clear. Mm. This law comes from the 1980 Refugee Act, which implemented our international obligations under the 1951 Refugee Convention. It says that anyone who is in the U.S. or arriving in the U.S., and the statutory language specifically says whether or not at a designated port of arrival is entitled to apply for asylum.
So you could be anywhere along the border, even inside the United States, and ask for asylum.
And ask for asylum. And the law is very clear about that.
Sarah made the point that a number of these refugees or migrants coming from Central America claiming, you know, either threats from gangs, even domestic violence. But if you don't have evidence, how does someone who is assessing whether someone should have asylum or not, how do they make that determination?
So it's a complicated process, clearly. And what you can do if you have a legal representative is the asylum seeker can gather a variety of types of evidence to support their claim. Those can be, first of all, an asylum claim under the law can be granted based on the asylum seeker's credible testimony, so just what they say. They can also bring in documentation from their home country, from friends, family, relatives, coworkers. They can also bring in experts on country conditions who know what's happening in those countries. There are a variety of ways to prove these claims. But the one thing that's probably been made clear by how long I've been talking about it is that it takes time right. to process those claims fairly.
Months.
It takes time to gather the information. And what I'm really worried about is the adjudicators getting enough time to sit and think through these claims carefully, which is not what's happening in the asylum system today.
Do we have enough adjudicators?
I don't think we have enough adjudicators. And I think what we've seen over the past decade or so is that while spending on border enforcement has increased dramatically, we have not seen a concomitant increase in resources focused on the fairness part of this process, on the due process, on the adjudication part of this process. Now, there are lots of statistics floating around. One that really struck me is the Border Patrol agents apprehended, each Border Patrol agent apprehended one migrant every 26 days in fiscal year 2018. That's how much money we're spending on Border Patrol. Now, if our judges could have 26 days, if our judge could even have half a day to sit and weigh the evidence and think through these cases carefully, we would be in a much different place, but we're not devoting sufficient resources to the process.
I mean, it appears when you look at what the Trump administration has done and said about people seeking asylum or even immigrants is trying to essentially criminalize the system, taking away birthright citizenship, taking away the ability to seek asylum according to the law. And there's a long list from there.
Right. Criminalize and stigmatize. I think create a picture of who should be a citizen and who shouldn't be a citizen that now excludes, because of the travel ban, right, people who are of Muslim origin, and now we're seeing on the border people of Central American origin, and this idea that certain people shouldn't be welcome and others should be, and right, as evidenced by Trump's comments, which is pretty concerning in this land of immigrants that we live in.
Well, it is curious, and we were talking about this before going on the air, is that, yes, we are a country of immigrants, and yes, we have not always been, or maybe we have generally not been, welcoming of immigrants. There's a long history that we can look at.
Right.
It's such a curious contradiction.
There's a long and shameful history, and I think we were talking before about the St. Louis, right, the ship in 1939 that came with 900 Jewish refugees and tried to seek refuge and was sent back, where many perished in the Holocaust. So we've seen that, right, over time. An interesting change that I've seen in the research I've been doing right now. So if you look at public opinion polls over time, there's generally not popular support for admitting refugees. But what we used to see and what we saw in the 1980 Refugee Act is we saw these liberal and moderate Republicans who believed in this dream of America as a humanitarian nation, right, who welcomed people from abroad, who made our nation stronger. And certainly there was some political interest there. This was the Cold War. But those liberal and moderate Republicans joined forces with Democratic politicians and stood up for these humanitarian values in the face of public opinion to the contrary. Now, not these were kind of 40% in favor, 60% right. against. So it wasn't right. like they were completely bucking popular opinion. But now instead what we see, I think, are politicians seeing that they can gain from fear-mongering, that they can gain votes from fear-mongering rather than standing up for humanitarian values. And I think that's really a shame because that's not what our country is, I don't think.
You mentioned the 1980s. Of course, that's when President Reagan was the president for 8 years, and immigrants under his administration were relatively welcomed.
Relatively welcomed, though, right, we're seeing now kind of the 30-year cycle. So under the Reagan administration, we saw a lot after the Refugee Act of 1980, we saw a lot of undocumented migrants coming from the Caribbean, from Mexico, from Central America seeking asylum. And we saw Cubans and Nicaraguans who were fleeing communist regimes were often allowed to remain. But when it came to the Guatemalans and Salvadorans, we saw extraordinarily low grant rates, 3% grant rates, despite the fact that these folks were fleeing pretty violent civil wars. And of course, that gave rise to litigation in 1985, the American Baptist Church's litigation that was eventually settled in 1991. All these folks were allowed to apply for asylum because it was seen that they weren't given a fair chance. And now we see again, 30 years later, Central Americans at the border, and maybe we haven't learned our lesson from the 1980s.
And there's a whole history there of U.S. involvement in wars in Central America, certainly in the 1980s, just to add to the complexity of the situation.
Absolutely. And there's an even more direct relationship because a lot of the folks who came here in the 1980s, the children of those migrants ended up joining gangs in Los Angeles because that's what we do, right? The statistics show that recent immigrants generally have less criminal proclivities, but the longer folks live in the U.S., right? They join gangs for protection, and those gangs were deported back to Central America in the 1990s, and those gangs are now the ones that these people at the border today are fleeing. So it's really just...
This is the MS-13.
This is the MS-13, which is named after a street in Los Angeles.
Let me reintroduce you. That's Jaya Ramji Nagala. She's a research professor, associate dean for academic affairs at Temple University's Beasley School of Law, where she teaches refugee law and policy. And we've been talking about the conflict, the crisis at the U.S.-Mexico border, and talking about the numbers, the thousands of refugees who are looking for asylum here in the United States. And again, if you want to join us, here's that phone number. It's 1-888-477-9499. Radio Times at WHYY.org. That's how you can reach us. And you can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me put something else on the table, something that you wrote, something you referred to as refugee roulette. And it's interesting. I mean, the process is obviously bureaucratic, but how important is it that that clerk, that first person that you come to, that you're granting or not granting asylum depends on who that clerk is?
So, right. So that study was, we looked empirically at adjudication at four levels of the asylum process, including the asylum office, which is part of the Department of Homeland Security, and the immigration court, which is a part of the Department of Justice. And what we saw from our statistical research was that actually, the identity of the adjudicator really matters a lot, and it shouldn't, right? These should be based on the situation in someone's home country, the legal standards. They shouldn't be based on the proclivities of the adjudicators. And what we learned from interviewing a lot of these adjudicators, and other research has shown, that as their time gets more and more squeezed, they tend to make decisions based on gut instincts rather than on the papers in front of them, which take a long time to get through. So again, it's all a question of resources. And that's what we said in that paper, that we need to professionalize this system. We need to give these adjudicators the resources they need and want to make good decisions. And we're just not doing that. Instead, we're pouring money into border enforcement.
Is gender, sex, I mean, of the applicant, how important is that, if it's a man or a woman?
So that was not hugely important. Interestingly, the gender of the immigration judge was hugely important. Women were more likely to grant asylum than men.
Interesting.
That didn't bear out, though, at the asylum office level. And the asylum office had, at that point, a lot more training and maybe a lot more time to make adjudication. So again, right, if we want a professional system that works well, we've got to give these folks time. and resources.
Let me read a tweet here. In the spring, a group of migrants, only 250 received asylum status. What did the others do? A liberal Ninth Circuit held that the gang violence wasn't enough to qualify for asylum. So what's the plan B for these folks? And if I can add to that, according to former Attorney General Jeff Sessions, domestic violence and gang violence was not a criteria anymore for asylum.
So that decision, matter of AB, which was decided in June, is being challenged in the courts. Grace versus Sessions, who is no longer our Attorney General, there's a challenge in the District of Columbia that's winding its way through the courts now. The decision in matter of AB was really just a gross misreading of the law on the books. Ever since the 1951 convention, it was conceived that non-state actors could be perpetrators of the violence that would lead to asylum. And what Sessions is saying is you really have to have government involvement or your government has to be completely helpless. Mm-hmm. Now, that's never been the standard. That's not the standard in the case law that he cites. I should say I signed on to an amicus brief that walked through all of the cases he cited and said that's not what the case law said. And he overturned a decision from 2013 that had said that domestic violence could be a basis for asylum. So what's happening is, right, these interpretations are being challenged in court, and I think his interpretation is fairly far off, certainly far off where U.S. law was, and I think far off the international standards.
I'm thinking, though, about 6,000 people who are apparently in Tijuana looking for some kind of asylum and the need for an orderly process. I mean, you don't want people, you know, storming the gates or the concertina wire or whatever we have down there. We have to figure out a way to make this process understandable and clear and fair.
I think that's right. I think so. So in my dream world, what we could do if we were willing to devote the resources to it is that we could have regional processing somewhere much closer to home. This is a real flaw going back to the drafting of the 1951 convention. And again, in the wake of World War II, there were displaced persons, populations of displaced persons throughout Europe. And so the governments who were drafting it were, again, worried about massive groups of people coming across the border. Right. So they simply didn't address this, which meant what we have now is that there's no right to safe passage from the country where people are fearing persecution to the country where they're protected from persecution, which means they have to take these extraordinarily treacherous journeys to get to safe countries. That's why these folks are traveling in a caravan, because the journeys are so unbelievably dangerous. They get exploited at every turn, and they know that they're vulnerable. So they're moving in a group, right? So what we could do, and there is some precedent for this, because this is what happens with refugees, is the UN High Commissioner for Refugees goes in to where the refugees are in refugee camps, processes those applications. We have U.S. members of the refugee corps who go abroad and process those applications. And then the International Organization for Migration is set up to bring those folks mm-hmm. here to the U.S. We tried that once with the Central American Minors Program, woefully underfunded, not well designed. But we really could do better, and that would be better if there were a system like that that worked. That would be better both for the refugees who wouldn't have to undertake these treacherous journeys and also for the countries receiving those folks.
If I were a native or a citizen of Guatemala, would I have belief that the system would be fair to me? I mean, I'm thinking about people applying or appealing for asylum in their home countries, right. And right. Would the system really help them?
Right. So there are lots of complications. So you might want to leave your home country. You might not be safe there. So it might have to be somewhere close by where they could be safe. And I think right under the current system, I think folks would have a hard time thinking it would be fair. But I can envision a system where we were devoting some more resources to this that could actually mm-hmm. be fair and could work and could prevent folks coming to the border, which is just not a situation anyone wants.
My understanding is that the Trump administration, I'm not sure Mexico has signed on to this, and obviously they're getting a new president on Saturday, whether the application would take place in that country versus in the United States or at the U.S.-Mexico border. Does that speak to what you just said?
Yeah, there? I mean, possibly. I mean, as we heard from, I mean, so first of all, the migrants have to, the journey to Mexico itself is treacherous, and they face a lot of danger in Mexico. And as Sarah started to spell out for us, right, these situations are not safe, particularly these border zones can be unsafe because unsavory characters know that there are vulnerable asylum seekers there and they're going to go there. So it has to be thought through in a way that the process can move reasonably quickly, that people can be kept safe while the claims are being processed, and this doesn't work perfectly in refugee camps around the world, certainly, but we are a wealthy nation, and we should be able to do better. We should be able to devote more resources to making folks safe. Now, once people have gotten all the way to the southern U.S. border, we could just process them within the U.S. I'm really talking about folks who have to undertake treacherous journeys. And right, you think about how much it would cost you or me to buy a plane ticket to San Pedro Sula. Mm-hmm. Multiply that by 10 times. That's what these people are paying to be brought over here.
And
right?
These are poor people.
These are poor people. They don't have a lot of money. And right, they're not being brought. Even after they pay that, they're not safe.
Well, we're almost out of time here. You've laid out what you think is a much more humane and clear process. Do you have confidence that this country, the United States of America, will move in that direction?
So we're not there yet. I think I'm an academic. What I like to do is dream, right? I think in the short term, what's more realistic is providing more resources to process these claims at the border. That's really what we should be doing. And the expedited removal process, we haven't talked about that much yet, which is what these migrants would be subject to, is a special process that was put into place under the 1996 laws, came into effect in 1997, that was really devised as a screening mechanism to send people through and to get into the regular asylum process. And we could be sending people down to the border to do that today, and we should be.
Well, Jaya Ramji Nogales, thank you very much for joining us today in Radio Times. And if you want to hear more about the immigration migrant crisis, you can listen to The Why here at WHYY. We've also got a third guest waiting in the wings. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscowane, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. A Rhodes Scholarship is one of the most prestigious awards in academia, given to just 32 college students in the United States every year so they can study at the University of Oxford in England. This year's recipients, chosen from more than 800 applicants, reflect the diversity that characterizes the United States. That's according to the Rhodes Trust. Almost half of the Rhodes class are either immigrants or first-generation college students and includes 21 women, which is a record. Well, one of those scholars, Ania Moore, is our guest. She's a Philadelphia native. She attended City Public Schools, and she's finishing up her senior year at the University of Pennsylvania, where she's majoring in sociology and urban studies. She is the first in her family to attend college. Ania Moore, a great pleasure. Congratulations. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much.
You're so welcome. And to our listeners, you can call us 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation. So it's been about a week since you learned you are a Rhodes Scholar.
Yes.
Have you come back down to earth?
In some ways, yes, and in some ways, no. In the yes ways, I still have schoolwork left to do. I'm writing two theses, both of which have drafts due tomorrow, and I didn't work on them when I was preparing for my interviews. And in some ways, no, it's something that you dream about for a very, very long time that is, like, very statistically unlikely. So the fact that it happened and that I prevailed is something that I'm still sort of kind of processing and dealing with.
Well, and I would also think just out of 832 people out of 800 applicants, just sort of figuring out what it was about you think that attracted the Rhodes Scholar people.
So,
what do you think it was?
I think what initially attracted me, so the way that it works is your university recommends you, and there's about 800 of those, and then they limit it down to a little over 200. It's about 13 to 14 in the 16 regions. And I think what got me to become a finalist was definitely my story. I had a really strong personal statement that both weaved in my parents' lives, my difficulty into the work that I was doing. And then I think what really shined through in that final round, there were 14 15 finalists in Pennsylvania, and then two of us got selected, was, I've been telling my friends, I think I was a bit of the personality pick. I was definitely very sassy, have some slightly radical views on public schooling and on education in general and other social issues, and wasn't afraid to show that or my emotions and let the judges get to know me.
Well, don't ever lose that. That will take you far, I promise you. So what was it like? I mean, what is the process where you learn you are a Rhodes Scholar? How does that work?
And
you mentioned the fact there were 14.
Yes.
In Pennsylvania.
Yes.
Right?
So it's actually, and I was dreading this for months, it's such a unique experience. So what happens is that about 2 to 3 weeks before the final round interviews, you get an email saying, hey, you're a finalist. Show up on the Friday before Thanksgiving every year across all of America, all 16 regions. You show up, you have a cocktail party with the judges and all the other finalists. It's a really wacky thing. And then the next day, you go and interview, and then they deliberate while you're all sitting in a room like down the hall. They bring all 14 of you in after they're done deliberating, and they say, we're going to announce the names of the two scholars that we're picking in alphabetical order.
Kind of like Miss America, right?
Yeah, it's really, really interesting.
So were you shocked?
Oh, more than shocked. I was telling a friend yesterday, I think back to that initial moment, and I still can't believe it. To the other finalists in the district, they were incredibly bright, incredibly compassionate, just wonderful people, and I never saw myself being picked among them.
Really?
I remember after the cocktail party that night, I went home to my hotel and I cried. I was like, I'm never going to do this. I'm not qualified. Like, there's so many wonderful people here.
Do you feel qualified now, though?
Yeah.
I mean, not in an ego way, but just,
yeah,
you did this.
I did this. I do feel qualified. I deal with imposter syndrome, which is a huge thing that first-gen low-income students face all the time. But, you know, I'm sort of kind of just trying to live in the moment and celebrate my successes right now. Just because I won doesn't take anything away from those 12 people who weren't selected. They're still as wonderful. They're still as intelligent, and they're still as important.
Tell us, you mentioned the imposter syndrome, mm-hmm. and I should add that I think many of us, myself included, often feel that mm-hmm. imposter syndrome, that somehow we're going to be found out to be not the person that mm-hmm. people think we are. But as you said, first gen, low income, to use your words, that there's a certain kind of imposter syndrome associated with that. Help us understand.
Yeah. So first-gen low-income students and many people, not just first-gen low-income students, often believe that they were just lucky, that they got to the places that they got, whether it be college, a scholarship, a certain job, because they were not lucky, not due to the actual skills that they have worked hard to build up over their lives. And a lot of that, I won a Truman Scholarship as well back in March. And I remember the Rhodes process has been easier. I've been dealing with less imposter syndrome, but I was still talking to one of my friends in July about how I felt like I didn't win deserve Truman, and I won it like back in March, April. Wow. And just feeling like, you know, I wasn't enough, and that they just liked me because my parents died and they felt bad for me, not because I was necessarily the most intelligent or did the best work or anything like that.
Since you mentioned it, and mm-hmm. this is when I read about you, Anaya, this, I mean, made me heartbreakingly sad mm-hmm. to know that you lost both of your parents, your father when you were a senior in high school.
Yes.
Your mom when you were a freshman at the University of Pennsylvania.
Yes.
What helped you through that? And I'm really sorry to
Thank
know
you.
That you lost both your parents, especially so close together.
Thank you. I often say what got me through those toughest of warnings was three things. One, my students at the Henry C. Lee Elementary School, which my entire Rhodes application focused on, during my toughest of mornings, I was like, well, these kids are absolute stars. They get me up. They get me smiling. So I got up every morning, you know, largely due to them. Two was definitely due to my family. They tried their hardest often to pick me up as much as they could because they know I needed to survive this. That there was, my cousin Renee said on the day that my mom died, she was driving me somewhere, I don't remember where, but she said, I pray that, I know this is going to be your lowest moment and it only goes up from here and you just have to get through this. And they worked hard to help me to understand that. And then three is definitely I'm a religious person. My parents were religious. My nana was religious. So a lot of my faith and a lot of my telling myself that this isn't the end for me, that there's something greater out there for me and that I want to get through this. And yeah, it was right. It was tough, but it's been wonderful.
There was an article about you in the Inquirer where you talked about your parents and mm-hmm. their belief in you, but also their support mm-hmm. of education. You went to Philly Public Schools. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure, you know, they would be so proud.
Yeah, they definitely. I like to tell people I've been probably dealing with imposter syndrome my whole life. I just didn't have a word for it looking back on it, not feeling like I was ever good enough. But my parents were the people who saw greatness in me from the right. beginning. They said, you're going to go somewhere. We don't know where you're going to go because we've never been there. We don't even know what it looks like because we've never even been able to touch that area. But you're going to go somewhere and you just have to believe in yourself. And I spent so long running away from what they believed and then eventually just so happened to run into it, you know, through things like winning a Rhodes and a Truman and started believing and seeing what they saw.
What do you think? Why do you think they were so confident in your skills?
If I'm being entirely honest, I think a lot. I work with families and parents at Lee, and I think a lot of parents have faith in their children. Parents love their children. I think life is complicated, and that love and what they want for their children due to societal barriers isn't always able to shine through. But I don't entirely know how they knew, but I imagine when I have kids someday, I'll know.
Right. You'll see that spark, that thing. Here's a tweet from Ian. Henry C. Lee, a school parent here. We love Ania Moore and are so happy for her and proud of
Thank
her
Thank you
as
so
well.
Much, Ian.
And the Lee School's in West Philadelphia.
Yes.
How did you get hooked up with them?
So,
and you do a lot there, based on what I read.
Yes. So I like to say that I sort of kind of stumbled into Lee freshman year right after my mom died. Just so happened, did music and drama and choir in high school and didn't necessarily want to join an a cappella group when I got to Penn, but wanted to provide students with music training that I had never been provided when I was younger. So started through the music program at the Netter Center for Community Partnerships, which is a civic engagement and community service center at Penn, who have been some of my greatest supporters, and started directing the choir and then wrote this 75 long page paper.
You did?
Yes, I did, on family and community engagement at Lee the summer after my freshman year and as a part of this internship, and then started doing family and community engagement work after I wrote that paper, and I've been doing choir and family work ever since at Lee.
You described it as a safe place for you.
Yes.
Or a home yes. for you as well.
Yeah, Lee has been my home away from home. And times when I felt like I didn't necessarily have a home after my parents died and I was trying to, you know, build those connections back up and really learn to love and, you know, to trust and to just be happy again, Lee was what provided a lot of that for me. And it's just such an incredibly special place. There's you know, I spent a very long time when I was little, because I was naive, running away from where I grew up because I felt like I didn't belong. And then after everything was taken away from me that I did belong to, I ran right back to it. And Lee reminded me so much of, you know, of my public, of my neighborhood and my public elementary school.
And you grew up in Southwest Philly.
Yes.
Where did you go to elementary school?
I went to a little school named Penrose in deep Southwest Philadelphia, very close to the airport.
And I know exactly where you're talking about. And where did you go after that? Where did you go after elementary school?
And then after that, in eighth grade, I applied to Masterman, which is one of the magnet schools in the city, and I was there from 8th to 12th grade. Really funny story. I don't know. I'm not an incredibly brave person, per se, particularly when I was little, and I got the guts to tell my mom. My mom didn't want me to go because it was an hour away by public transport, and I said, Mom, either you sign this paper or I'll forge your signature. Either way, the application's going out. And I was like, looking back on it, I'm like, that's illegal. But, you know, She signed it.
Just to make sure that everything is all legal here. A tweet from Nick saying, what in your opinion can we do to make Philly schools better? I mean, based on your own experience at Lee, but also your own experience in the Philly schools, do you have thoughts, ideas about that?
Definitely. So I think one of the things, this might be very specific to my area, but I'm doing a lot of research on family and community engagement and gentrifying schools in particular. And I think one of the things that the Philadelphia School District can definitely be better about is sort of kind of monitoring their catchment and working with, you know, developers and how in gentrifying areas, working with developers and different people who are buying properties in those areas to make sure low income families aren't being kicked out. There are a couple key schools that I'm thinking of in particular where those catchments need to be monitored closely, and the school district needs to partner with the city of Philadelphia and the developers to make sure that affordable housing is still available in that area. Second thing is that you know, I am, one of my huge focuses is on family well being and on family and community engagement at schools, and looking at how we are providing parents with services that they need. I think one of the most beautiful things about Philadelphia education is this growing wave of community schools, and figuring out, instead of waiting, you know, for all the schools to be official community schools, encouraging our, you know, the staff members at our school, even if you don't have the official label, how can you start to build that up with the resources that you currently have?
What do you want to study when you're to Oxford in England?
So I actually haven't applied to Oxford yet. Most of the scholars don't apply till January, and I'm thinking through that right now. I'm interested in master's in public policy, and then also master's in comparative social policy. Ways, just, you know, those are really the two degrees in which I will be able to combine my love for education policy and also my love for family welfare policy, and sort of kind of see how we can do better community economic development and family well-being practices through education and locally.
I read, too, that you're interested in a law degree, being a lawyer?
Yes, I am.
That's your sort of ultimate goal, I guess?
Yes, definitely. So I want to go to Oxford for 2 to 3 years. I want to come back, either work somewhere in Philly or locally for a couple years. And then the goal is to ultimately go back to law school, get my JD, and then come back to the city to practice public interest law for low-income families here.
And you're really a real Philly booster.
Yes, I mean,
you love the city.
Yes, I love the city. I'll never know what the judges were thinking, but I think they got on me a little bit about that in my Rhodes interview. They were like, oh, she's so Philly. I'm not saying I don't know if they were actually thinking that, but it seems like at moments they were. And I was like, yes, I'm a Philly girl. That's how I introduced myself at the cocktail party. You all have to sit around in a circle and then you introduce yourself. Right. And everyone's like, my name is. And I was like, I'm a lifelong Philadelphian. My name's Ania. And it was just
good,
you know,
for you. You mentioned the fact you're first generation, you're low income student.
Yes.
At University of Pennsylvania. What was the biggest challenge for you? I'm taking you back, I guess, to those early couple of days, or even maybe early couple of weeks or months at Penn as a first gen student.
I think the amount of judgment that I received as a first-gen low-income student. On my third day at Penn, I was told by a professor when I mentioned where I grew up that I was lucky that I had not been shot. And the amount of judgment and sort of kind of stereotyping of my neighborhood, of my people, of where I come from. I like to say a lot of the things that happen at Penn are like, you know, sort of kind of hidden racism, hidden white supremacy, hidden elitist notions, or the elitism isn't hidden as much, but, you know, hidden classist, you know, property traits and properties. And I just think the amount of fighting and pushing back that I've had to do as a low-income Black woman who is the first in her family to go to college, to help people to understand, has been, you know, not the best. I will say this, though, is that Penn has a huge first-generation low-income student movement that is growing, and the university is trying to change the culture. We have our largest class of first-gen low-income students with the newest freshman class, and they're making a lot of progress in the area. So Penn's definitely an up-and-coming place, but, you know, before the up-and-coming comes the not up-and-coming.
Comes you.
Yes.
Well, Ania Moore, such a pleasure. Congratulations. We're also proud of you.
Thank you.
And again, she is a Rhodes Scholar, won a scholarship just about a week or so ago, just one of 32 college students in the U.S. going to the University of Oxford in England. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes and you can find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Alex Stern. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.